Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector, an independent financial advisor, or an institutional investor looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Being a good investor is much like being a great goalkeeper in a penalty shootout. Staying still can look risky, but more often than not, it's the smartest move. In this episode of our bi-monthly long game series, we're once again joined by investment strategist and Gibbs professor Adrian Saville to unpack why discipline and patience remain two of the most powerful tools in a world defined by noise, volatility, and the constant pressure to act. So let's get into it. Welcome back to the show, Adrian.
Thanks, Ron. Great to be with you.
Let's start with behavior. And my question is twofold. Why is it so hard for investors to sit still, even when history and data should suggest that staying put might be the smarter move? And do you think the pressure to act is worse today, given this the noise out there, the noise that investors face from social media, news, and all the short-term data?
You know, Ron, what got me thinking about this is the absolute barrage of news that has hit us through the course of 2025 in particular. It's been a very, very noisy, busy year. And as we're speaking, Japan has just been through elections and they have a change in government. That's just one of many that characterized the last 12, 18 months or so. And with all of this noise going on, the default is I have to do something as an investor. And you know, what is it that motivates it, to go to your question or observation? And I think there's two things that motivate the default to move, or if we use the goalkeeping analogy, the default to dive. The first is that it's an observed behavior. If most other goalkeepers, most other investors dive, move, then surely you should be doing the same thing. The second is, what happens if I don't dive? And if you don't dive and a goal is scored, then you look like you are, you're a slouch. You're asleep at the wheel. So rather dive and don't save the goal than stand still and have the goal scored. So it's a dangerous default position to assume, if you think of not only that learned behavior observation, but also the observations that are going to be made about you if you don't do something. And there's a lovely analogy from the world of football here. It comes from a study by Michael Bar-Ellie and in an article published called Action Bias Amongst Goalkeepers and the Case of Penalty Kicks. And he studied hundreds of penalty kicks. And what they found was, first, you know, as we are observing, 94% of cases, the goalkeeper dives left or right, approximately evenly distributed between diving left or right. But 94% of the time, the default was to dive. And then they go on to ask, what happens when the goalkeeper doesn't dive? And if the goalkeeper doesn't dive, the success of saving penalties doubles. So although this is a tiny, tiny incidence, just 6% of cases, you have a profound impact on your success of saving goals. So there's, you know, there's very rich parallels there with the world of investment. Just to sort of complete the story, in your intro, you spoke about goalkeepers. You know, investing is also about penalty shooters, strikers. And there's a quaint story that comes from 1976 UEFA European football final, where the then Czechoslovakia was playing the then West Germany. And 2-2 draw, and we're now late in a penalty shootout. And Czechoslovakia's Antonín Panenka is up to take the decisive fifth kick. And true to form, the German goalkeeper dives. Instinctively, he dived left. And what does Panenka do? He just does a little lob down the middle and scores the victory goal, which, you know, had Sepp Maier not dived, we would have had a completely different result. So, you know, there's a big story in this, you know, about how we now translate it into investment insight or an investment intelligence wisdom. With all of this noise, what happens if we don't dive?
Adrian, you used this football penalty analogy, and the technique was risky yet innovative at the time, and the move has since adopted its name, the Panenka. Yeah, in today's investment environment, what would you say is the equivalent of a Panenka play? What's the move that might look risky or passive on the surface, but actually shows deep insight and long-term conviction?
And just comes right down the middle and delivers a magnificent result. Having insurance in your portfolio in a world which over the last 15 years has been all about risk on, look at the upside, interest rates, spending more time closer to zero than in positive real interest rate territory, economic growth seldom disappointing, inflation bumping up, modestly once through just post-COVID, but broadly speaking, the last 15, 20, even longer years have been a world in which you have been paid handsomely for taking risk. And the Panenka is, there are other things that might materialize. And the soft lob down the middle has been having 10% of your portfolio in physical gold, which has now, in the fullness of time, delivered better returns than the S&P 500 over that exact period.
Let's turn to the global macro picture. The US is wrestling with ballooning debt, a softer dollar, and election year volatility. China, meanwhile, is dealing with structural slowdowns. You've just mentioned Japan earlier. How should South African investors make sense of these shifting plates?
You know, Ron, the two that you flagged there, we've spoken about before on this podcast series, but the two that I think we should be giving particular attention to are the United States and China. Just given their raw economic size and the financial integration of the US in global matters in particular, and China in global financial matters, and China in global trade in particular. So you've got these two economic giants with deep financial and industrial integration, yet both of them face real structural challenges. In the case of the United States, it's the size of the debt, the size of the deficits. We've just had a big, beautiful bill, which is not going to deliver any fiscal magnificence. It's going to bring more trouble to the United States. The U.S. has already gone, comfortably above 120% debt to GDP. That's a worrying number. And if you go and look at pricing of financial assets, in particular credit default swaps on the US. Those credit default swaps are now being priced in territory similar to Italy and Greece. To me, if that doesn't scream risk and, structural challenge, I'm not sure what does. The US dollar has sort of softly responded with a 10% sell-off. I wonder if there isn't much more to come out of those sales, given the fiscal position in the United States. Unhedged dollar positions sit at 13 trillion. These are eye-watering numbers. So the US has got a whole lot to wrestle with, fiscal and financial. And then China, their problem, if anything, might be even tougher to solve, and it's their demographic decline, that China now has a shrinking workforce, making it the first country to get old, inverted commas, before it's got rich. And that presents all types of challenges to their productivity, their industrial competitiveness, their ability to attract and retain foreign direct investment, and more. And so it starts to take China in the direction of what's been referred to as Japanification, low inflation, disappointing economic growth, not only low inflation, deflationary tendencies. So these two economic giants have got big problems to solve. South Africa, I think, for a long time has been obsessed with the dollar, and also for a long time has been the beneficiary of Chinese industrial performance commodity prices. So for South Africa, watch out for commodity price disappointment, industrial commodities in particular, and be alive to dollar risk.
Adrian, is geographic diversification more important than ever, or are there still concentrated opportunities that justify risk in these two regions?
You know, what I'd say in response to that is you made earlier reference to Japan. We've just seen Japan come through an election. They now have a change in government underway. And this is one of many countries that went through change of government over the last 12, 18 months. It's been an extraordinary period in terms of political outcomes, all the way from tiny Botswana to, you know, massive India, having changes in government. South Africa is no exception, change in government. And this takes us into a world of increasing political fragmentation. So I think from an investment strategy perspective, rather than looking for hegemony, you know, ease of doing business across border, large trade blocks, I think you need to be quite deliberate and specific in looking for opportunities and looking for places where you can, A, find industrial and economic resilience and competitiveness, but B, also place confidence that the political arrangements are going to withstand challenges rather than land up in, you know, drama and locked up assets or, you know, isolated economic political isolation, i.e., you know, sanctions as a case in point. So you want to be very, very deliberate in a world that, to my mind, is about greater political fragmentation. But go looking for the opportunities, absolutely.
Adrian, you quickly touched on commodities, and we've seen strong rallies in gold, silver, platinum, and even Bitcoin. Is this a return to hard assets as a form of protection or just another reaction to market anxiety? And also, where do you stand on Bitcoin? Is it a hedge or a hype?
I love that question. Can I answer? I don't know. On Bitcoin, which is, I mean, we've been wrestling with this for a long time. This has to be one of the most spoken about asset classes. And as I'm saying it, I'm doing air commas because I'm still not entirely convinced that it's an asset. It certainly isn't a currency. I'll be firm on that. To talk about Bitcoin as a currency, I would say that that's in the terrain of hype. Why? Because a currency needs to be stable. It needs to be broadly accepted. It needs to be a unit of exchange, a means of exchange, a unit of account, etc. And Bitcoin does not tick those boxes. That doesn't change the fact that it has performed fantastically from an investment perspective. And what is it that sits behind this? My default position on this is go to the brilliant thinker, Nassim Taleb, who suggests that the long-term fair value of Bitcoin is zero. That's my default position. Then we've got, you know, on the other hand, in good contest, the likes of Michael Saylor suggesting that his 2045 target price 20 years from now is $13 million per coin. Buy one then, you know, in your institutional portfolio. If you, you know, a person of sufficient private means, buy one. If your $123,000 is going to go to $13 million. So I think you want this in your portfolio. This might be the lob down the middle. You want some exposure to Bitcoin, but it cannot be, you know, bet the house, bet the farm on this, simply given that Bitcoin has absolutely no cash flow generating capability. In the same way that if I said to you, put all of your money in gold, you might want to do a double take on it.
There's compelling research that breaks investors into three camps: noise, momentum, and valuation. You've long advocated for valuation-led strategies. Why do you believe valuation is still the most reliable path in the long run?
Well, you know, Rian, the reason why valuation, you know, to me, make sense for at least two very good reasons. The first is I understand it. You know, if you've got an asset that generates cash flow, that it has intrinsic assets underneath it, you can look at it, you can touch it, you can get to sensible ways of figuring out the worth of it. You know, the most obvious and naive being doing something like a discounted cash flow model. And to me, that just makes sense, you know, as opposed to having an asset that you look at and you say, well, because it's gone up and because other investors like it, I'm going to buy it. That's momentum. Or, you know, another approach, you know, referred to it as noise. Trump has done this, therefore I'm going to do that. What if Trump changes his mind? I have no control over Trump. What if someone else comes along and does something, you know, that negates Trump's pronouncement, et cetera, et cetera. So noise is exactly that. It's incredibly noisy. It's wonderful if you get it right. But, you know, just think of random information arriving at the market and you're trying to make sense of it. Momentum is wonderful when it's working in your favor, but momentum when it changes its mind is brutal. Whereas a valuation-based approach, even if I'm wrong, you know, I can take comfort that there is an intrinsic value in my asset that is above the price that it paid. And if I've got the ability to be patient in the fullness of time, that intrinsic value will be recognized and rewarded. That's a long answer, but that's my firm, you know, grounding in a valuation-based approach. And then we've got empirical evidence that says of these three different investment approaches, valuation is by far the more consistent in delivering long-term results.
Adrian, as you mentioned, so much attention is being drawn to momentum or narrative-driven trades. What practices or processes have helped maintain discipline, especially during volatile or emotionally charged periods?
Well, listen to the noise, but try and stand still. You know, make sure that the noise is exactly that, that it isn't some fundamental or intrinsic in a change. So, dropping bombs that don't really have an impact that is claimed, that's noise. Dropping bombs that ignite World War III, that's news. So I think we have to always be alive to the very big distinction between noise and news. And then, you know, if we look at what really drives performance in the fullness of time, it really boils down to a single decision. And that is your long-term strategic asset allocation. If you get that right, you can get a whole lot else wrong. Getting your strategic asset allocation right is one of the most kindest things you can do to yourself from a long-term investment perspective. It'll get you to the ultimate harbor.
Adrian, why do you think asset allocation is so underappreciated? And how do you go about constructing resilient portfolios when the future is so uncertain?
You know, asset allocation is underappreciated because it's not sexy. it's much funner, far more entertaining and engaging to talk about, you know, the price of something that has moved from A to B over the course of the last, you know, 2 weeks, that NVIDIA is once again the largest company in the world. That's far more interesting than talking about, you know, whether we're going to move to our nominal bonds to inflation protected bonds, or the size of commodity, how we size commodities in our asset classes. So talking about individual ideas, talking about things that are making headlines, far more interesting. It's a bit like goalkeepers diving, you know, far, far more interesting as a goalkeeper to dive than to stand still in the same spot. So that's why I think it distracts us or grabs our attention as investors. It doesn't change the fact that we want to spend the bulk of our time worrying about asset allocation. I'm reminded also of you know, the work of David Swensen, who ran the Yale Endowment, an incredibly successful venture, the Yale Endowment. And Swensen, in his seminal work, talks about the three sources of return: market timing, security selection, and asset allocation. Market timing is a not only incredibly difficult to get right, but it is it's a net zero game for those that are timing. The people who win in market timing are matched by people who are losing in market timing. Security selection this is the stuff that I referred to earlier, sort of sexy. It's so interesting to talk about. It really gets people sitting up. But security selection is, when we look at long-term investment results, only 1 in 5, 1 in 10 security selectors have successful long-term results. So that leaves us with Swensson's third bucket, asset allocation. And that is where the rump of your lifting from investment performance comes from. Worry about asset allocation.
Adrian, before we close off this conversation, for advisors and fund selectors listening to this podcast, what's one practical takeaway they can use when guiding clients through volatile markets?
Well, I hope, you know, that our conversation, you know, rather than just being an animated story about goalkeepers and goal strikers, you know, gets people to think very personally and privately about what does this mean for their motivation when they read the latest report, listen to the most recent news? Is the urge to respond and react, and would that put them in the territory of the diving goalkeeper? I think that that's one of the key messages, that I get from this evidence and data. And then, to spend time in thinking about investment returns, not to be seduced by the story of the day, but rather to look at much longer term investment results and wonder or inquire whether it has been driven by stock selection, market timing, or asset allocation. And if it has been driven by stock selection and market timing, I think you then want to ask the much harder question, has the person who's been doing the timing and the selection been lucky, or are they truly skilled? I think those are the tough questions that you can ask that will equip you in your investment decisions.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Adrian, for joining us again on the show and helping me compare economic principles against investment decisions. We'll speak to you again in a month or so for another long game discussion. To all our CityWise South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uster, and my producer, Alan Walsh, from the CityWise Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We're available on all major platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iono.fm. And until next time, stay smart, stay sharp, and stay diversified.